Hi, this is Eric Mann of the 4 o'clock hour on KPFK with voices from the front lines, thinkers, doers, and activists. I'm on the phone with Vijay Prashad, author of War Against the Planet and Fat Cats and Running Dogs. He's a professor at Trinity College in Connecticut. The subject is We Got 'Em, the capture of Saddam Hussein by the bad guys. So one of the things I was thinking about, Vijay, is that in your book, The War Against the Planet book, you have a terrific chapter about the whole history of how the United States, in the effort to defeat communism and socialism in the Third World and the Middle East in particular, built up right-wing, often religious and theocratic fascists with the explicit goal of getting rid of the secular left, not just the communists, but the entire secular left. And now, as Malcolm said, the chickens are coming home to roost. When I saw this picture of Saddam Hussein being caught, here's a man who's a mass murderer, a religious fanatic, a right winger. I had some sympathy for him. Actually, my first instinct was strangely empathetic, like the runaway slave has been caught. How do we address this particular contradiction? And one more thing in your opening statement is now the press is saying, well, his big defense may be the dirty laundry defense, that he's going to come out and indicate all his ties to the United States and say, what's the problem? I'm your boy. So give us some sense how you've been thinking since you've been a student in the Middle East. We're going to get to strategy later, but at the level of analysis, where do we begin by the capture of Saddam Hussein and its implications for the crisis in the Middle East?
You know, Eric, it's a pleasure to be with you. The first thing that I thought when I saw the picture of him, you know, at his dental exam, that's the image that I saw. I immediately thought of an operation that the Israeli Defense Force had conducted in October. It was called Operation Root Canal, and it was the biggest Israeli entrance into Gaza in a year. And I kept, for some reason, thinking about Operation Root Canal and this image of the dental hygienist or doctor with the gloves poking into Saddam's mouth. The feeling that we have this ability, not only, of course, amnesic ability to forget the past, but we have this ability to demonize Palestinians, Arabs, to such an extent that we allow them, you know, we allow this kind of surgical intervention into their bodies and we don't afford them any dignity. So the only feeling I had when I looked at him was, you know, you are scum. Even when it came down to the last moment, you were unable to redeem your past or anything. You know, you come out crawling, begging, saying, I'd like to negotiate. You are the worst kind of dictator. You know, you all end up like that. But the thing is that we also completely dehumanized him. We did to him what we complained about when the Iraqis were putting American POWs on the television, you know, saying that this is a contravention of the Geneva Convention, etc. So, yes, that contradictory feeling is there. You feel sorry for them because they are being humiliated and dehumanized. But Saddam Hussein, of course, is not somebody that one only feels sorry for. He is, after all, exactly as you called him, a mass murderer. And Saddam Hussein, as they said in the 1960s, came to power on an American train. And the parallel story here is Manuel Noriega, or people like that, you know, other dictators who, when they became uncomfortable to the empire, had to be extricated. You know, this is a form of pulling them out in a way, you know. They would extract these assets who went bad and put them in some jail in Florida and hope that the exercise of extraction will make us forget the history of the alliance. That's the brilliance of the way propaganda works, is that we'll extricate him, we'll take him out, we'll make some kind of deal with him in which we'll say, you get life, but you have to be silent. You have to be silent about that history. So the press might talk about dirty laundry, but the image that we'll remember is Saddam's humiliation and not his handshake with, say, Donald Rumsfeld in Baghdad in 1984.
Well, I think one of the things that I know you as a political scientist and a political educator, we wish the problem is only George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld. The problem seems to go so deep into the political psychology of the United States, a country built on empire, built on slavery, built on genocide. There's not a very self-critical, introspective strain in U.S. culture. It's not like people would say, on one hand, he's a mass murderer, he attacked his own people, created genocide against the Kurds, which I would like you to talk about. On the other hand, he's our creation. One of the introspections for me is that I believe very strongly in the principle of self-determination, and certainly for third world countries, and I believe in virtually complete self-determination when it comes to the United States, who's going to try to intervene in everybody's country. But the dilemma is, what are alternatives, what could have been done for a left to put pressure on Saddam Hussein about the internal murder of people in his own country, at the same time as building a case against the invasion, which is nothing more than an occupation right now?
Well, you know, then let's go back a long ways. The first thing I think to keep in mind is that, yes, this country, the United States, is born on empire and on slavery, but it's never seen itself as an empire. And that has to do with the principal delusion that we have never had a territorial colony. You know, so Britain had colonies in India, Africa, other parts of Asia, and in the Americas, in the Caribbean, etc. And the French had their territorial colony in Africa and Caribbean. The United States has claimed since the inception of actually being opposed to colonialism, not having colonies. When in fact the westward expansion and the removal of Native Americans, the capture of large parts of Mexico, I mean, essentially was a territorial colony. This is long before 1898. This is long before the actual takeover of the Philippines. We often forget you are in Los Angeles, but, you know, that's Mexico. And we won in battle, colonized, captured territory, and are still, in a sense, colonial in parts of Mexico. But there is a delusion in our history and in the way we imagine ourselves of being people who are opposed to colonialism, opposed to the direct conquest and rule over people. And in that sense, we've been able to comfort ourselves with the belief that any time we intervene abroad, we intervene to help people against worse people. So, you know, the Monroe Doctrine in Latin America, the goal of that ostensibly was to prevent old Europe from dominating our neighbors, when in fact it was explicitly about us being in charge of the Americas and not allowing our rivals in Europe from cutting in under us, in our own backyard, as it were. And it's the same kind of language in West Asia and has been since the 1950s. It's been about promoting the liberty of people. So we say when we go in to overthrow leaders that we're not going in to actually take you over, but we're going in to give you a better leader. And this has been our game for at least 50 years in West Asia. And it's patently true that, you know, in West Asia in the 1950s, the most dynamic force was Nasserism, was Arab republicanism, was this belief among the Arabs that there is an Arab nation that needs to be redeemed. And the leader of that was the Egyptian military man, Gamal Abdel Nasser. There were clones of Nasser all across the Arab world, including, of course, in Iraq. There was a great revolution in the 50s led by Qasim, Brigadier Qasim, a very interesting man, not a friend entirely of the left, but nonetheless he had a position about the right of the Iraqis, the right of the Arabs to create a destiny that wasn't dominated by Britain, France, the United States, the Soviets, etc. He was in alliance with the Iraqi Communist Party at that time, and Saddam Hussein's organization, the Ba'ath Party, which was also Arab nationalist, was the other side of Arab nationalism, whereas Nasserism was about some kind of soft form of socialism. You know, the state must control the basic assets of providing welfare for people, in other words, like health, education, etc. Ba'athism, which is the other side of Arab nationalism, was really a much more cruel form of nationalism. It was about how certain kind of ethnicity must come to the fore, not a certain notion of rights must come to the fore. You know, Nasserism was always about rights of people. Ba'athism was always about the ethnicity. You know, in other words, ethnic cohesion was much more important than, say, a Bill of Rights. And the Ba'ath have been like that in Syria and certainly in Iraq. So when the Ba'ath appeared as the alternative to history of creating rights in the country, I mean, rights is something that imperialism disdains. Because, you know, when the dark people of the world start creating states based on rights, then they'll demand a right to their own resources, for instance. And Iraq has always been oil-rich. In the 1920s, in fact, the empire carved up the oil resources of Iraq. So there's a long history of carving up the resources. So when Qasim comes to power in the 50s, he comes to power on this train of rights, you know, that everybody must have right to control their resources. So this is the reason, in a way, that empire started to promote Baathism, made friends with people like Saddam Hussein, encouraged him. Certainly Saddam was a man who played all sides against the middle. For a while he allowed the United States to back him. Then when it became more prudent for him to get Soviet backing, he went with the Soviets. And eventually, when he went to war with Iran after the Iranian Revolution, you know, when Iran had become, in a sense, our great Satan, when we needed an ally against Iran, Saddam appeared on the scene. He goes to war against the Iranians. And one has to remember that the gassing of the Kurds, the gassing of the Iranian troops, I mean, we talk about the Kurds, we forget that the Iraqi army fired chemical weapons against the Iranian army. Brutal. I mean, the Iranians had an advantage in terms of troop size. They had a much larger army. But the Iraqis were very much better equipped with chemical weapons from the United States, with all kinds of armaments from the United States. The Iranians were, in that sense, at a disadvantage. So they would send, you know, thousands of troops onto the battlefield, and the Iraqis used chemical weapons. So both the chemical weapon attacks against the Kurds and against the Iranians were part of a battlefield situation, and the Iraqis had absolutely no compunction about maintaining any human rights or anything. They used them, in both cases to kill thousands of people. This was well known at that time. This is the stuff of 20 left-wing people standing on a street corner in a city with signs which say the Iraqis are gassing the Kurds, the Iraqis are gassing the Iranians, and cars drive by, people laugh at you, the press pays you no heed. I mean, this kind of thing is happening today around the world. I'm sure in front of the City Hall in Los Angeles there'll be vigils, people standing, trying to alert people of the world to some of these atrocities. But at the time, nobody cared. The United States government didn't care. The very day, in fact, that the United Nations tabled a report on Iraqi war crimes in 1983, that very day, Donald Rumsfeld arrived in Baghdad. He shook Saddam's hand. There was no mention, no criticism at all of the use of weapons of mass destruction.
That is Eric Mann, KPFK 90.7 FM, and with Vijay Prashad, professor at Trinity College. Two things. One is in a disagreement that while it's true the United States has never had any formal colonies, I don't think that's what fools the people in the United States. I think the people in the United States as a whole are fully aware that we have colonies. Slavery was not a secret. The conquest of Mexico is celebrated in every single film and holiday as the Remember the Maine. I mean, people do believe that the United States owns the Philippines, owns Hawaii. People say, I'm going to Hawaii, and you go there, and there are virtually no indigenous people, and people are owning condominiums there. They know they're taking other people's land. In terms of the area now of hope, there's two options. One would be the development of, again, a secular left in the Middle East. But the second, in the short run, would be that many of the forces that the United States has brought into play still create some havoc for the occupation. As someone who's rooting against the success of the occupation as a very elemental component of self-determination, what hope do you think there is right now? I mean, they're saying it's a quagmire, but the relatively small number of casualties in the Middle East right now are nothing compared to what the United States was willing to suffer in Vietnam in return for killing 3 million Vietnamese. So I don't believe that one or two or three casualties a day is going to lead people to want to get out of Iraq, because I think it's tied to a lot of people believe in blood for oil. So where do you see the deeper contradictions in the Middle East developing in Iraq? What do you see the future of the U.S. occupation from the point of view of the forces in Iraq right now? What are the possible failures of the occupation strategy?
One thing to bear in mind is that the secular left in the Arab lands was put into despair and defeat, both by a combination of Israeli and American pressure but also by immense funding from the Saudi government. The Saudi government continues to fund, all kinds of Islamist groups. They backed Hamas for years. They backed Islamic Jihad. They back all these groups essentially as a counter against left groups. If you take the Palestinian case against the Popular Front, against the Democratic Front, they want the minimization of those forces, and they've promoted Islamism. But it doesn't mean that the secular left has disappeared. The secular left still exists. And I find it interesting, for instance, if we go back to the case of Iraq, when the governing council was proposed, very quickly, the Iraqi Communist Party, said we'd like a seat at the table. And in fact, they had been in dialogue with the authority, the occupational authority, from just after the fall of Baghdad. Now, what I find interesting is the knee-jerk criticism of people around the world of the secular left for, as they say, collaborating with the American occupiers. Now, I think we need to see this on many perspectives. But I agree with you. This is not a quagmire, that there is immense resistance and anger at the brutality of the occupation. I think there is an immense misunderstanding by the Pentagon and the United States government of nationalism. We look at Iraq and see it in terms of ethnic division, when in fact there is a sense of Iraqi nationalism and patriotism which has been which is being enacted in this resistance. So, it may not be a quagmire, but there's still some kind of nationalism. When those elements of the secular left that decide to enter something like the governing council, when they do so, to see it as collaboration with the Americans, I think is not to see the political possibilities that those forces, are confronted with. They can't sit this one out. They see themselves as collaborating with the Iraqi people and not with the Americans. They are still in opposition to the occupation, but they want to be there fighting for things like, basic supports, healthcare, trying to ensure that things are not going to be wholesale privatized. There's a problem in sitting out this dance. And so we see the secular left, but just like the secular left, say, in places like Brazil or India, etc., they are in an amazingly difficult position having to negotiate with, the really crushing weight of military power. They are also under the pressure of this ideology of there is no alternative to privatization. A friend of mine wrote recently, their vision is Tina, there is no alternative. Our vision is Sita, socialism is the alternative. But socialism is the alternative. We don't yet, in places like Iraq, have concrete demands, apart from simply no privatization. When everything is being held in the occupying power's hand, what can one do? And I think people are, beginning to organize, beginning to see things. When you see that the first newspaper out in Baghdad after the occupation was the left newspaper, and it's a fairly open newspaper. I've seen, what they've run in there, and it's not, one political line. It's fairly open-ended. There are some discussions, some debates. There is a little bit of hope there. I think people are burnt out by the dynamic of Islamism. I don't think that has that much effective, long-term strength. There are secular problems that, that have alerted people, that bother people. So there are, in that sense, there are hopes. I'll give you, if we go to the Palestinian story, in Palestine, Hamas has become, in a way, the loyal opposition to the Palestinian Authority. The group that apparently is growing in places like Gaza is not Hamas, but Islamic Jihad. They are in some ways more democratic than Hamas. They are able to do military actions without going through, lots of, checking from above, etc. But they also deal with neighborhood problems, which Hamas does not do with the same kind of openness. It's a much more virulent and dangerous political ideology. But the fact is, they have combined both fighting for immediate reforms and fighting for something great, they, of course, believe in something great being jihad. But in Iraq, you can see that the left, which is re-emerging in the neighborhoods, they used to anyway have the best network. You talk to any human rights activist in the United States who's written anything about Iraq, and they tell you that right through the dictatorship of Saddam, the only way they got information about events taking place in Iraq, it was not through the Shia groups. It was through the Iraqi left, which maintained neighborhood groups, very, very underground, very surreptitious, but they were able to keep themselves alive. And this is what's coming back above ground. So I, frankly, don't feel the same urgency to criticize them. You know, our comrade Tariq Ali, for instance, has written saying that they have become collaborators. I think that's not a very good political approach to people who are struggling in very complicated circumstances to make some room for a secular opposition.
Well, I'm not informed enough to, nor do I particularly love getting involved in line struggles inside the third world, because I think continually that's one of the weaknesses of the U.S. left, is that the line struggle should be, how do we develop conditions in the United States to get the Bush administration out of Iraq, and then allow the forces inside of Iraq, who have different theories of self-determination, to be able to carry that out. One of the things I was struck by, is the United States, in terms of its exit strategy, is going to probably claim it wants free elections, but I don't think it wants free elections in Iraq. I think it wants to control resources and create its own form of junta. But what's always fascinating in politics is all the best plans, even of the most powerful empire like the United States, have some limits to it. So if the Communist Party in Iraq is proposing a united front, for instance, on a free election campaign, right, might just take that as the issue, which would then allow the Communist Party to run candidates or to allow a multi-party state. Even if the reality is that the political economy of Iraq is going to be owned by the United States, and now I do find it very funny that Germany and France are very outraged that they're not getting their cut of the pie, you know, this strange debate about is Bush being vindictive or fair, and the Germans and French are sort of saying, I was against the war, but now there's an occupation, I want in. So I think there are just so many contradictions, and for the Iraqi left, I think that one of the demands that does seem from afar very important is to leverage a free election and the largest number of civil rights and civil liberties, which would allow the next round of struggle to build an Iraqi left on the ground.
Yes, and this is exactly what the demand is. The demand is for free elections. Now, here's the problem. The problem is that people worry, well, are the conditions there for free elections? And this is the debate that is taking place among the left. You know, on the one side, people are saying it's free elections immediately, and the other side says, well, free elections has with it a premise, which is the conditions for free elections. Now, you know, you can see what's happening in Afghanistan. The parallel story about a year, you know, it has a year historical advantage over Iraq. They are now sitting with their second Loya Jirga, or the Council of Elders. And, of course, the big fight there is that the Council of Elders, the president of it, Mudagigi, who, you know, interesting man, he was a very close ally of Charlie Wilson, who was a congressman from Oklahoma, you know, very flamboyant congressman who organized the funding for the Mujahideen in the 1980s. And, you know, this man, about, you know, at the beginning of the Loya Jirga, said essentially that women are half of men. You know, that it takes two women to make a man. It erupted. I mean, the Loya Jirga went with, you know, people were yelling, screaming. Of course, these are our great allies from the 1980s. And, you know, again, you see the contradictions come up because the women's groups are the most powerfully, you know, with the, they actually have an ideology. And they came in there and fought strong and hard based on the idea of one person, one vote, you know, an idea that Afghanistan knew in the 1970s, and they want a renewal of that. So, you know, Afghanistan, where there was also this fight in the left, you know, saying free elections or conditions for free elections, Afghanistan, they decided that it was more important to create the conditions for free elections. So you had this, you know, empire, you know, which delegated its nominee, Hamid Karzai, who ran Afghanistan for 3 years, etc. Well, the fact is that the so-called conditions approach has produced mayhem and chaos itself. So there's nothing to merit one way or the other. But I think the demand for free elections is very important, and that's what people are, I think, raising that as a standard. But they are simultaneously talking about refusal to privatize. And I think that that is very significant, that both things are being said at the same time. On the one hand, free elections, we require political freedom, and secondly, no privatization. In other words, we require economic freedom, as we define it, you know. Economic freedom defined stateside, of course, means freedom of corporations. But Iraq has known economic freedom to mean the rights to certain basic needs. Even though the Ba'ath was about ethnic cohesion and mass murderers, etc., they provided basic needs of the population far more than most other Arab countries, you know, which is why, you know, until the 1980s, late 80s, when the effects of the Iran-Iraq war devastated the Iraqi economy, until then, equity among Iraqis was much higher than in any of the other Arab countries.
This is Vijay Prashad, professor of, what are you professor of, Vijay?
International Studies.
International Studies and World Thought,
World
at Trinity College. Let's end with this, that the prerequisite for any kind of positive change in Iraq is obviously the withdrawal of the U.S. troops. Even if they operate through puppets, even if they operate through conditions that we can't control, I think for people in the United States, we don't have to debate privatization versus socialism in Iraq. We don't have to debate preconditions for elections or elections in Iraq. I know as a strategist and tactician with my group, the Bus Riders Union, we stay up till midnight every Wednesday night debating our own tactics. It's not obvious what to do in an actual struggle. So the question, though, is, well, is obvious what to do is getting the United States out. What's difficult is how. And I want to end with your thoughts about the Democratic Party, because I'm concerned about Howard Dean's commitment to get out of Iraq. I'm concerned about the so-called internationalization through the United Nations. What's it going to look like for the United States to get out of Iraq? And have you been following the Democratic candidates and have opinions about their actual politics of withdrawal from Iraq?
I think there is no exit strategy. I think the tragedy is when you listen to the generals who are in command in Iraq, they talk about a few more years, two more years, one more year. It's so vague that my, you know, thinking feeling is there is no exit strategy. When you read the positions of the Democrats, and, you know, when I've looked at, you know, the leading candidates, it's quite terrifying. I mean, in a way, I think this is a situation where the Democratic Party is ready to give birth to a new LBJ. You know, I'm not sure that Dean has enunciated an exit strategy. The only one who has something of a strategy is Denis Kasunich, but his strategy is handed over to the UN. Now, the UN is not really entirely, on this point, a neutral actor. You know, on this point, I think there is a great deal of disgruntlement in the General Assembly over the fact that, you know, it will be soldiers from Pakistan, India, etc., who go in there wearing, you know, the blue caps under the blue flag, subbing for United States soldiers, but not able to control the dynamic. I mean, you know, one of the things, one of the discussions we need to have before we champion the UN on foreign policy is the sheer lack of democracy over the UN troops. You know, that's held by not the General Assembly, not all the countries of the world that are members of the UN, but by the Security Council, which is dominated by the five nuclear powers. So the five nuclear powers essentially masquerade for the United Nations when it comes to so-called peacekeeping. So there's a, you know, one has to ask questions about whether the UN troops is really a good replacement for the American forces. Ideally, you know, a demand should be made for American troops to leave and the Arab League to send in security forces to take care of security. I mean, this was the position taken in West Africa with the creation of the West African Security Force. And there's some merit to that, you know. On the one hand, we have fight and demand and protect the right of nations to have sovereignty. But I think we also should think about regions having sovereignty over security matters. You know, this was a goal put forward in the year, I guess it was 1999, 2 years before we invaded Afghanistan. There was something called a Shanghai Group, a group of Central Asian countries and China had met in Shanghai, and they decided that they would take care of Afghanistan as regional actors who have to live with the new Afghanistan that is produced. So there might be some way for us to think about regional questions of, you know, ensuring the security of the Iraqi people. But, you know, one has to also remember that Iraq had and has an extremely literate population. They have a very professional, sector of society. And I don't see why there is such great difficulty and despair over turning over security to an elected Iraqi government. I mean, partly the undercurrent here, I think, is this racist belief of the Arab as incompetent and as devious, etc. And we forget that Iraq used to have a very high literacy rate. It deteriorated during sanctions, but it's still quite high. So I would say that before we talk UN, before we talk, extended U.S. Troops, etc., which is the way the Democratic Party seems to be thinking and the generals seem to be thinking, we need to think about regional solutions. We need to think about, the Iraqis being competent people themselves. And this I'm not hearing from the Democrats. It's sad to say that the most left-wing Democrat here, Denis Kucinich, can only say let's turn it over to the UN. There's no analysis of the limitations of the UN in its peacekeeping role.
Well, I think that's a really good way to end, because I think the most provocative point that Vijay Prashad is making is that if the UN is not much more than a fig leaf for the United States, or a fig leaf for the United States, Germany, France, China, and Great Britain, anybody who's actually worked at the World Summit on Sustainable Development, the World Conference Against Racism, sees the way the UN really works, sees that it's not much more than another adjunct for the United States. But the concept the UN with of Iraq for the Iraqis and letting the different factions in Iraq figure out the future, since allegedly getting rid of Saddam Hussein was to create that opening, is a very provocative way to end the discussion. So thank you, Vijay Prashad. We hope to have you back on the show again. And this is KPFK 90.7 FM.